In 2010, the largest oil spill in American history captivated the public's attention. Authorities told a story of a response effort that prevented a worst-case scenario. But if you ask some people who lived through the spill, they'll tell you a more complicated story.
They weren't attending to the workers.
I was bleeding from everywhere.
We were all lied to.
From Western Sound and APM Studios comes a new investigative podcast, Ripple, available now.
Cholera and dengue fever cases are spiking in parts of Africa and Asia, and at the root of this deadly trend,
climate change basically multiplies all of those problems.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Since the start of the war in Gaza, dozens of Palestinian journalists have been killed.
When you kill a journalist, you're robbing the world of a witness to history.
We'll hear about an effort in South Africa to stop an auction of personal items owned by Nelson Mandela. And we'll experience Turkey's lavish, leisurely breakfasts.
It's always part of a family, and it reminds me of home.
Turns out, though, those meals can also be pretty wasteful. Plus, a new Hindu temple in India opens where a mosque was torn down by a mob not so long ago.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's good to be with you this Friday.
As our planet warms up because of climate change, it's altering how diseases spread. Right now, cholera cases are surging in Zambia, and dengue fever is on the rise in Bangladesh.
I reported on something similar in late 2022 in Pakistan. Sindh province in the western part of the country had been hit by major flooding, also related to climate change. Here's some of what I saw there.
Malaria cases in Sindh province were three times higher in August than a year earlier. A young boy just tested positive after a finger prick for a blood test. His uncle, Ali Khan Jamali, says the boy has been sick for 8 days. He's not eating or drinking, Jamali tells me. He gets fevers often.
For more on the connections between climate change and infectious disease, we reached out to Dermot Campbell-Lindrum. He's the head of the Climate Change and Health Unit at the World Health Organization and is in Geneva. I began by asking about the link between dengue fever and climate change.
Yeah, so dengue is a very serious disease. Generally, when people get their first infection of dengue, they get a very severe flu-like illness, but that can be extremely severe. But the connection between climate and dengue is really rather strong. Because the disease is transmitted by mosquitoes, mosquitoes are cold-blooded animals, and as the temperature heats up, it means that they can spread to new areas. It means they're generally more active for longer. It means that they also bite more often, so that gives it more of a chance to transmit the disease. The other thing is that the infectious agent of the dengue virus that they carry also can survive better in higher temperatures, and so is more likely to be transmitted. And you multiply that as well with the fact that climate change is also increasing humidity. It's also causing more extreme rainfall, which causes more flooding, which causes more standing water, which is where the mosquitoes breed.
I want to talk now about cholera, which I mentioned is surging in Zambia. This is spread by contaminated water. Can you explain the link between cholera and climate change?
So the link there is, again, that warmer and wetter conditions make it easier for the bacterium to survive and replicate. But the real challenge with climate change and cholera is that more unpredictable rainfall can lead to flooding. It can lead to overflowing of sanitation systems, so contamination of the environment. And also even droughts can contribute to the same problem. Because as we get more variable rainfall patterns with climate change, sometimes we've got too much water, so flood. Sometimes we don't have enough water, so drought. And in droughts, it's hard for people to maintain good sanitation and good hygiene. So that also favors the transmission of the disease. I should say that for many of these diseases, it isn't just climate change. So cholera in particular is a disease of poverty. So it really affects those people who are in the poorest sanitary conditions or have the worst water and sanitation supplies.
You mentioned, of course, that climate change isn't the only thing happening here. Are countries that already have other high risk factors, like you mentioned, poverty, not great access to clean water, are those places the same places that are likely to see increased risk due to warming temperatures?
Well, they are, because we say that climate change, for the most part, doesn't create new diseases. It makes existing problems worse. So if you already have a high burden of cholera and other diarrheal diseases, or malaria, dengue, or malnutrition, for example, that is because you don't have good social conditions, people are poor, they don't have good health services. Climate change basically multiplies all of those problems, which is part of the great inequity, part of the great unfairness of climate change, because it is those people who are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change who have contributed least to the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the problem.
I'm wondering if you can put the climate change contribution to human health in perspective when we think about all of the risks that make people more likely to fall ill. How much is it likely to play a role in the future when we think about things like smoking or obesity or heart disease?
Well, climate change is already playing a significant role. So there's already enough information for us to know that we need to act. The difference between climate change and what we would consider traditional health risk factors, like smoking or unhealthy diet leading to obesity and so on, is that it doesn't affect just one disease or a couple of diseases. It affects the whole system. So it affects a very wide range of diseases, and it actually undermines all of the things that we need in order to maintain good health. So it destroys water and sanitation supplies. It undermines food security. It destroys health systems. So it's almost like an Uber risk acting over all of the others.
You mentioned reducing greenhouse gas emissions and putting better protection systems in place. Can you talk more about what is or should be done to better prepare for the health impacts of climate change, aside from the very obvious one of reducing emissions?
We need to maintain and increase the support for basic health system functions, because what really makes people vulnerable is if they don't have that protection there in the first place. So we need to keep supporting our malaria control programs, the cholera programs, and so on. The next thing that we then need to do is to take account of the increased risks of climate change and the specific risks that come from climate change. So we know, for example, that heat stress is already a big problem. We know for a fact that climate change is making it worse and will make it much worse. So we need to start specifically addressing the risk of heat, particularly in cities, and putting in place early warning systems and so on.
When we think about climate change and health, where is the biggest impact going to be felt? Is it going to be the direct impact of heat on health?
What I would have said if you'd asked me that about 5 or 10 years ago would be that it would be the increased impacts of climate change on the big burdens of disease in poor countries, particularly malnutrition, malaria, and diarrheal disease. That's still true, but we also see increasing evidence of the impacts of climate change in richer countries as well. And heat stress is a really good example of that, that we are seeing more and more people suffering from extreme heat. The other new risk that probably always been there, but people were only just starting to become aware of it and get the evidence, is the impact of climate change on mental health. And that's both the effect, for example, of climate change, increasing floods, droughts, impacts on people's livelihoods, directly impacting on mental health, but also emerging evidence, particularly among younger people, that their lives are actually disrupted by concern about the future because of the very clear evidence of what we're doing to the planet.
Dermot Campbell-Lendrum is the head of the Climate Change and Health Unit at the World Health Organization. He joined us from Geneva.
Since the deadly Hamas attack in Israel on October 7th and the Israeli military assault that began soon after, people from around the world have been following the news from Gaza. But reporting that news has been incredibly dangerous. Between the cross-border attacks between Israel and Lebanon and the fighting in the Gaza Strip, an unprecedented number of journalists have been killed or wounded. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
This is one of very few videos that Jarrah Shahroor has of his friend Aysam Abdullah. It shows the two of them hanging out at a shawarma restaurant. Abdullah is, as usual, being funny and witty, Shahroor says, full of energy. Abdullah was a journalist for Reuters news agency. On October 13th, he and a group of reporters were filming near Lebanon's border with Israel when they were hit. A Reuters investigation later found that Israeli tank shells killed Abdullah and injured 6 other journalists. A month later, the Israeli military said Abdullah was in a combat zone and that they were reviewing the case. Shahroor, Abdullah's friend, is still processing what happened.
Always thinking that it might be a joke, like when everything is finished, Issam will come back.
His death has left the journalist community in Lebanon in shock, he says. One of his colleagues who was there on the day, Christina Asi from AFP, was severely injured.
What happened? I can't feel my legs.
Asi had to have one of her legs amputated. Not far away in Gaza, the situation is even worse for media workers. The Committee to Protect Journalists says more reporters have been killed in the first 10 weeks of the war in Gaza than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. The Israeli Defense Forces have told news agencies that they cannot guarantee the safety of journalists working in the enclave. There are Hamas-affiliated media organizations in Gaza. Israeli government spokesperson Ilan Levy did not respond to my interview requests for this story.
What's alarming in Gaza is the rate at which journalists are being killed.
Clayton Weimers is with Reporters Without Borders, a Paris-based press freedom group. His organization has filed two complaints with the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes committed by the Israeli army against Palestinian journalists in Gaza.
We have received the assurance of the ICC prosecutor that they will be specifically looking at crimes against journalists in their investigation.
Weimer says in the past it has been difficult to get cases of journalists killed to be included in ICC investigations. He says Reporters Without Borders has been gathering its own evidence. It's been reviewing video footage and talking to witnesses to try to understand the circumstances in which journalists were killed.
You know, in some cases, they were caught up in an airstrike while they were out on assignment reporting. In other cases, they were shot while interviewing subjects.
Israel denies targeting journalists, which under international law is a war crime. Weimer says this is not because the life of a journalist is worth more than any other civilian.
But it is a class of killing in its own because when you kill a journalist, you're robbing the world of a witness to history.
In the case of Gaza, this is even more of a problem, he says, because Palestinian journalists are getting killed and Israel has prevented international media from entering Gaza. Palestinian journalists in Gaza have been reporting and living through the story. The case of Wael Dahdou, who works for Al Jazeera, has received a lot of attention in the past few weeks. Dahdou lost his wife, three of his children, a grandchild, and several other members of his family during this war. Yet he continued to report. The Israeli military published a document that it says shows Dahdou's son, Hamza, was a member of a terrorist organization based in Gaza. His family denied that, and some experts have questioned the accuracy of the document. This week, Wael Dahdou left Gaza for Qatar. Jad Shahroor, who lost his friend Issam Abdullah in Lebanon, says reporters have a huge responsibility.
We have to say the truth. You can be a banker, you can be a doctor, but when you are a journalist, you know that you are under threat.
Saying the truth, no matter the cost, he says. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now to Niigata Prefecture in central Japan, where couples are getting out their marital frustrations at an annual winter festival.
It starts with husbands dressed in kimonos being carried through town. Then they're brought to the top of a snow-covered hill, and the real fun begins.
Locals there are yelling, "Ready, set, go," before throwing the men down the slope. There's a lot of snow to catch them, so it doesn't seem like anyone's going to get hurt. The husbands then roll down the hill where their wives are waiting to catch them at the bottom.
According to Japanese broadcaster Nippon TV, this tradition is aimed at strengthening the bond between married couples. Still, one woman who looked on as her husband was tossed like a rag doll admitted that she enjoyed watching him flying through the air.
Nelson Mandela's personal effects might be going up for auction, but some South Africans say that's not okay.
That story is coming right up. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Hearing aids, a government-issued ID, and gifts from American presidents. Those are some of the personal items of Nelson Mandela that are going up for auction. But South Africa's Heritage Resources Agency says, not so fast, these are national treasures. It's trying to prevent them from being sold. The anti-apartheid leader's eldest daughter is planning to auction off those belongings and others from her father's estate, but the issue remains tied up in court. Bernadette Wicks is a South African journalist based in Johannesburg. Bernadette, who owns these belongings now, and in whose hands are they?
Well, in terms of who owns these belongings, that's really in dispute at the moment. So originally, news of a looming auction at the time broke in early 2022. And when that news broke, there was a lot of controversy around it. And in response, the South African Heritage Resource Agency, also known as SARA, approached the auction house, Guernsey's, in New York. On the back of those engagements and those interventions, a decision was taken to call off the auction. However, the items remained in the States. And so SARA went to court in a bid to get these items sent back to South Africa. Now, according to SARA, these are national heritage objects. And so they maintain essentially that they belong to the state. According to the former president's oldest daughter, Makaziwe Mandela Amwa, who we understand facilitated these items being sent over to the States in the main, these are personal items that belong to her. So that's really the question at the center of all of this.
Well, what's interesting is Makaziwe Mandela Amwa, she says the proceeds from the auction will go to creating a memorial garden in her father's honor. What do we know about those plans?
Yes, we understand that she would like to use the funds to build a memorial garden in her father's home village of Qunu in the Eastern Cape. And that's what she has said this money would be used for. However, the idea of auctioning off these items doesn't sit well with a lot of South Africans. And some South Africans have pointed to the fact that there are various other funding sources that they feel could be approached and would be happy to assist with something like this.
So where do things stand now? I mean, this has been to-ing and fro-ing for a couple of years now. Who gets the final word about whether these things can go to auction?
Ultimately, the decision has been made in the High Court that these items can go to auction. But in terms of South Africa's legal system, that decision can now still be appealed, firstly to the Supreme Court of Appeal, which is a court that basically focuses on appeals of this nature. And then ultimately, they can still take that decision even further to the Constitutional Court, which is the highest court of South Africa. And whatever it were to rule would be the absolute final say on the matter.
Is this the first time the Mandela family and the government of South Africa has tussled over Mandela's legacy, or is it just the latest?
It's certainly not the first time that there have been tensions around the former president's legacy. There have also been concerns around the heritage items and things like the homes he lived in having fallen into disrepair over the years. So there certainly have been tensions in the past. And I think that's understandable considering that, of course, Nelson Mandela was a global icon. And you can imagine in South Africa what an absolute figurehead and iconic person and character he was. But then you also have, from his family's point of view, the fact that this was their father, this was their grandfather, and we know what they lost and what they struggled for and what they sacrificed as well as a result of what he had to sacrifice for the struggle for democracy in South Africa. So there are all these competing interests at play, and it's an emotional issue because of who the former president is to the country and because of who the former president was as a man to his family.
Bernadette Wicks is a journalist in Johannesburg talking about the controversy over a possible auction of personal items owned by the late Nelson Mandela.
Weekend breakfasts in Turkey are an almost sacred event, with sumptuous spreads of delicacies enjoyed at a leisurely pace. But this tradition is fueling concerns about food waste. Turkish breakfast is meant to be enjoyed as a bit of this and a bit of that, which means lots of food is left on the table for restaurants to just throw out. The world's Duru Buskaran heads to Istanbul's breakfast street to find out more.
In the older parts of Istanbul, your shopping is done street by street. There's a street for musical instruments, for tools and building supplies, another for cheese and spices.
Bravo!
So it's natural that there is a street for breakfast, Çelebi Olu Sokak. Here, diners sit at outdoor cafes with magnificent breakfast spreads, known as the Serpme Kahvaltı. Restaurants compete with each other for the most elaborate, the most unique, or simply the most Instagrammable take on old favorites. At Cafe Carmenta, the servers will read your fortune in the traces of coffee grounds left over in your cup. This guest's grounds are in the shape of a ring, a good sign for her career. Okan Demirel, a psychology student celebrating the end of exams with friends, says the full Turkish breakfast is an easy way to get people together and talking. It's also a long-held tradition. His childhood memories of being forcefully woken up on Sunday mornings for serpme kahvaltı with his parents at home. Another diner, Bengin Tulum, says a restaurant breakfast brings those memories back.
It's always part of a family and house, home. It reminds me of home.
To the untrained eye, Turkish breakfast can seem like chaos. There are tomatoes and cucumbers dressed with sprigs of fresh parsley, eggs scrambled with tomatoes and peppers, two types of olives, feta cheese, soft cheese, string cheese, cheese rolled in phyllo dough and fried, savory donuts, fried, French fries, fried sausage, savory pepper paste called ajuka, homemade jam, honey and clotted cream, and to top it all off, a Black Sea specialty of melted cheese and cornmeal, eaten with bread like fondue. You're not expected to eat the whole thing. And that's kind of the point, says longtime Cafe Carmenta server Ferdi Avli. There are a ton of options, and you might not be able to eat them all, but you'll at least have half, and you'll like all of them, Avli says. At restaurants, the uneaten food left on the table is thrown away, and the waste generated by Turkish breakfasts has long been a sticking point, especially in light of the country's financial crisis.
Son zamanların en çok tartışılan konularından biri serpme kahvaltı.
Famously, one historian appeared on the Kanal 7 news channel, calling the full Turkish breakfast a complete vulgarity. This year, a citizen petition to ban Turkish breakfast entirely even made it to the country's parliament. Turkey's National Restaurant Association has jumped on the cause, suggesting that restaurants offer a la carte options, where diners choose and pay only for the dishes they plan to eat. But Turkish breakfast is also an income generator and a point of pride, a small luxury that people can afford once in a while. It's part of Turkish culture, says Cafe Carmenta owner Bahar Yel. The more variety there is, the happier you are. If you have guests in your home, you offer as many options as possible, she says. As a restaurant owner, she tries to reduce waste by serving portions based on the size of the group or suggesting that tables order for fewer people if they aren't very hungry. But ban Turkish breakfast entirely? Never. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
For many Hindus in India, the inauguration of a new temple in the town of Ayodhya is a miraculous event.
That we can't express by words. That's like, you can only feel that.
But mob violence on the very same site once sparked deadly anti-Muslim riots and the destruction of an historic mosque. That story's ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The journey to the Summer Olympics in Paris is well underway. For many aquatic sports athletes, that journey will soon take them through Doha, Qatar.
That's a promotional video from World Aquatics. Their championship begins in 2 weeks. It's the final chance for athletes to qualify for the Paris Games.
But there's one national delegation that's ringing the alarm over safety concerns in Qatar. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
On August 26, 1972, the Israeli Olympic delegation walked in the opening ceremony of the Munich Games to outsized applause. The team's 15 athletes started competing and living out their dreams right away. But everything changed in the early morning hours of September 5th.
Early this morning, armed Palestinian guerrillas raided the sleeping quarters of the Israeli team.
Shot and killed two Israelis and held nine others hostages all day and into the night.
Kidnappers demanded the release of more than 200 Palestinians being held in Israeli custody. A shootout ensued, and 11 members of Israel's Olympic delegation died. The Munich Massacre, as it's now known, is history that continues to worry Israeli athletes.
Do you really think that you could compete at your best if that's going on even a little bit in your head while you're swimming or diving or playing water polo?
That's Eric Spitz, whose daughter Ayla Spitz is on the Israeli national swim team. By the way, they're not related to Mark Spitz, the famous swimmer who competed at the Munich Games. Eric Spitz says his daughter's team travels incognito due to safety concerns.
If you've ever been at an airport and you see the basketball team from the local college, they all come in gear. You recognize them. That's not the case when the Israeli teams travel.
Those concerns have only been heightened since October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel. And they're really coming to the surface at the World Aquatic Championships next month because of the host country Qatar's ties to Hamas.
The sponsorship that Qatar has been providing for Hamas goes back a while.
David May is a senior research analyst at the Nonpartisan Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Qatar has always played this role where they try to be seen as an international mediator for Hamas, but they're Hamas's allies.
May says Qatar has also made a major push to host international sporting events, like the 2019 World Athletics Championships, the 2022 Men's FIFA World Cup, and now this year's World Aquatics Championships.
But at the end of the day, none of that erases the support that they have been providing for a group that is committed to destroying Israel.
That's why Spitz is concerned about his daughter and the entire Israeli delegation traveling to Doha. He launched a website called NoToDoha.com and sent an open letter to the International Olympic Committee asking them to prioritize Israeli and Jewish athletes' safety.
There's an easy out for the IOC, and that is qualify or sanction some other events that are not in Doha to be Olympic qualifying events. If they do that, they don't have to move the games from Doha. They can let people do Doha and somewhere else.
Spitz says the IOC initially acknowledged receipt of his letter.
But since then, I've heard nothing.
In a statement to the world, the IOC declined to comment on the safety concerns in Doha. But at a press conference yesterday, IOC spokesperson Mark Adams commented on protecting Israeli athletes this summer in Paris.
This is always a matter for the local authorities, but we're in constant contact. We do have very high confidence in the authorities to make sure that these games are safe and secure.
Via email, a World Aquatics spokesperson told me they are working closely with both Qatari and Israeli authorities to ensure a safe event next month. World Aquatics and the Israel Swimming Association are also in conversation, with the latter telling me their participation in Doha will depend on the security standards at the competition. David May says, though, he doesn't see a viable path forward.
I don't think the Qatari government is able and potentially not even willing to guarantee the security of Israeli athletes. I don't think that there's anything that they can do at this moment, so long as they continue to host Hamas and be a major patron of Hamas. So long as that continues, Israel will not feel secure.
In an email, a Qatari official told me Israeli athletes have safely participated in major international sporting events in Qatar over the past few years, and they're committed to ensuring the safety and security of everyone at the upcoming World Aquatics Championships. The competition is scheduled to begin in Doha on Friday, February 2nd. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The past few years have been difficult for Haiti. The country's last president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated in 2021, and since then, the country's social and political fabric has been torn apart. In the coming weeks, it's possible that Kenyan peacekeepers will be deployed to Haiti. Earlier today, I spoke with Harold Isaac. He's an independent journalist based in Pétionville, Haiti. If we look back at the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, was that really a turning point for Haiti?
For most observers and analysts, it was perhaps the last straw, because Haiti essentially has been facing both an institutional crisis and constitutional crisis for most part of the last 5 years. And it culminated with the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. And ever since, the country has been, for the most part, exposed to an uncertain situation with an unclear path forward.
What has to happen for there to be a path forward?
elections are a must in Haiti as soon as possible to renew institutions and try and get us out of the constitutional crisis. However, before getting to elections, you have a security crisis with gangs taking over nearly 80% of the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince by estimates.
How did the gangs in Haiti become so powerful?
Well, historically, gangs have been weaponized by political actors for electoral purposes. They've grown more and more emboldened and became criminal enterprise of their own, taking over whole neighborhoods and terrorizing populations. They've became a key player in the Haitian political spectrum. They're imposing their agenda.
What's the agenda of the gangs? What do they want?
Well, for the most part, gangs have been taking over neighborhoods and areas to be able to extort, kidnap, ransack, and essentially become fully operating criminal enterprise that are making money off regular businesses or regular folks. A good part of the violence that has happened in the last few years has been related to gang clashes because they are also rivals and they're fighting each other. So it became a very murky and complicated situation for regular Haitians to navigate on a daily basis.
So for you, what's daily life like now in Haiti? I mean, what's happening?
As I was telling a friend of mine, it's really, you know, about navigating this complicated reality. It's about trying to run your errands in a safe way. Overall, there are some safe areas, such as where I'm at right now in Pétionville. If you're venturing anywhere else, you need to have a clear plan as to how you're getting there and how you're coming back and trying to avoid being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
What do Haitians think about the possibility of Kenyan police forces being deployed there as peacekeepers?
Well, the formal request by the Haitian government for an international force of some sort to come and help deal with the gang violence in Haiti has been done over a year ago. For most folks that I'm talking to on a daily basis, I think what hurts the most is the fact that the country is divided, is separated physically now in at least three parts, the north, the west department where we are, and the south. So it's not easy for folks to commute up north safely or to commute down south in the country safely. So they feel, for the most part, secluded in their areas. One of the key, perhaps, objectives, although it hasn't been exposed as such, of the mission will be to liberate the national roads, which are for the most part controlled by gangs.
And does that affect you directly? Do you only stay in the west part because you can't get to the north or south?
Well, it does. If I need to go up north for work, I travel by plane. So that's the reality for anyone who has to go, or others who cannot afford that will take their chances and pay toll to the gangs to get to wherever destinations they're going to, even though it's not a guarantee of safety.
Harold, what is the most hopeful thing happening in Haiti at the moment?
Well, we have a jazz festival next week in Port-au-Prince. But I'd say...
Well, that's pretty exciting, actually.
It is quite exciting, actually. But that being said, I mean, being in Haiti on a daily basis is an act of resistance for average folks because they have to figure out making a living and they also have to keep themselves safe and their family. What I see in folks' eyes here is courage. For many folks, they feel if they are here and they're not considering leaving the country, it's almost a duty to be here and fight every day.
Harold Isaac is an independent journalist based in Pétionville, Haiti.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed in space.
A Japanese spacecraft today touched down on the moon, making Japan the fifth country to put a lander onto the lunar surface. Officials had hoped to be able to pinpoint a specific landing spot with this mission instead of aiming for a wide area, as previous landers have done. They say they don't yet know whether they pulled it off.
Meanwhile, a U.S. lander burned up yesterday upon re-entry into Earth's atmosphere above Australia. The craft was launched by a Pittsburgh-based company. It suffered a fuel leak shortly after takeoff that prevented it from reaching the moon with instruments that the company was hoping to deliver for NASA.
Yet another moon mission is planned for next month. An American company is aiming to put the first lunar landing craft on the moon in more than 50 years. NASA wants to commercialize lunar deliveries while the agency works to send astronauts back to the moon. And that's a few things you might have missed in space.
Next week, in a small town in northern India, a new Hindu temple will open its doors for the first time. This is no ordinary holy site. To many Hindus, the event represents a victory at the end of a long struggle. But it's also a win for Hindu nationalists in India just ahead of elections. Sushmita Patak reports from Ayodhya, about 400 miles southeast of Delhi.
Hindu hymns are interspersed with the constant thud of construction in Ayodhya these days. Workers in orange helmets put final touches to a new boulevard. It leads to a grand pink sandstone structure surrounded by huge construction cranes, barely visible through the winter fog. Even a glimpse of it leaves pilgrims overjoyed.
Feeling is like a miracle. It's a very pure feeling that we can't express by words. That's like, you can only feel that, pure devotion.
Teenager Kritika Chaudhary and her family traveled over 350 miles to see the temple. It's dedicated to Ram, one of the main deities in Hinduism. Millions of Hindus consider this a holy place, says her father.
We are so excited. We believe in Ram. My name is Ram Kumar. And to pay regards, respect to Lord Ram, that's why we are here.
Ayodhya is where Hindus believe Ram was born thousands of years ago as the son of an emperor. According to Hindu texts, he is the ideal man. He obeys his stepmother when she banishes him from the kingdom. And when his wife is kidnapped by a demon king, the warrior prince fights valiantly to save her. Ram's triumphant return to Ayodhya is celebrated by Hindus as Diwali, the festival of lights. The mood in Ayodhya these days is equally festive, if not more. Because Lord Ram is returning to Ayodhya once again, says local shopkeeper Suchi Kumar. We've been waiting for this moment for 500 years, he says. Hindus like him believe there was an ancient Ram temple in Ayodhya, at his exact birthplace. But in the 16th century, they say the Muslim emperor Babur displaced their beloved deity by destroying it and built a mosque instead. Despite little evidence to prove that the Babri Mosque was built on temple ruins, it became an epicenter of Hindu-Muslim tensions, which exploded on 6 December 1992. A frenzied mob of Hindus who'd come from all over the country attacked the mosque. They flattened its three domes with pickaxes and metal rods. Riots broke out, killing hundreds across South Asia, one of the bloodiest bouts of violence in Indian history. All over a small patch of land. The same place where on Monday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi will consecrate the imposing new temple.
Mera saubhagya hai ki mujhe bhi is punya avsar ka sakshi banne ka.
I'm fortunate to witness this blessed moment. I've never been so emotional in my life, Modi said recently. Just down the street from the temple, I meet Muhammad Shahid. His grandfather was the last imam of the Babri Mosque. As the mosque fell and riots erupted, Shahid, 22 at the time, took refuge in a police station. The rioters killed my father and uncle, he says. They attacked other Muslim shrines and tore off pages of the Quran. Dozens of Muslim homes were set on fire, including that of Azim Qadri, who was 8 at the time. Sensing the turmoil, Qadri's father had sent him off to relatives in the next town. When he returned, it felt like his neighborhood had been hit by an earthquake, he says. Our mosque was snatched from us, but we have accepted our fate. Ayodhya's Muslims want peace now, he says. Some Muslim families in Ayodhya are leaving town next week out of caution, as Hindus across India flock to the temple. Hotel prices in and around the small town have skyrocketed. Chartered flights are crowding its recently opened airstrip. Ravi Karkala is part of the temple's trust.
There's a lot of craze among people. People are waiting for the temple to open. They are running out of patience at this time because this is a big, big civilizational movement.
It's also a big moment for Modi's party, the BJP, which led a grassroots movement in the 1980s and 90s to build a Ram temple in Ayodhya. On that fateful day in December 1992, just before crowds charged at the mosque, BJP leaders were giving fiery speeches. Sanjay Kumar is with the Center for the Study of Developing Societies in New Delhi.
BJP's commitment for Ram Temple, BJP's commitment for the cause of Hindus has been unchallenged And there has been no, you know, wavering in terms of BJP stand on that.
Now the BJP has delivered on its promise, just in time for polls.
It's going to be the biggest factor in 2024 elections. There are other factors which will help BJP. But if you compare standalone Ram Temple as an issue or as a factor for mobilizing vote in 2024, this is going to be the biggest factor.
A few decades ago, building a temple in place of the mosque was unthinkable, says Kumar. To diffuse tensions, many Indians wanted a hospital to be built on the disputed site. That has changed now. There's a sense of euphoria about the temple. And the fringe ideology of Hindu nationalism or Hindutva is front and center.
Hindutva politics is the mainstream politics. Hindutva is the way to move ahead. All political parties are trying to toe that line.
Modi's critics say it is a decisive moment in the creation of a Hindu first nation. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Ayodhya, Northern India.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Recognize this track? It's nearly 40 years old now, but it seems like just about everyone, old and young, knows at least the chorus. We are the world. We are the world. We are the children. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving. So let's start giving. We Are the World, the 1980s all-star pop hit for famine relief in Ethiopia. There's a new documentary about the making of the song. It's called The Greatest Night in Pop, and it aired today at the Sundance Film Festival. The World's Jerry Haddon reports on the impact the song had in saving lives then and today.
They came together for a single recording session on January 28, 1985.
Bob Dylan,
Stevie Wonder,
Paul Simon,
Cindy Lauper,
Bette Midler,
Billy Joel,
Steve Perry,
Willie Nelson.
That's from the trailer for the new documentary. In all, 46 superstars showed up to belt out Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson's now iconic song.
It's not about the person. It's about how rich the sounds behind it are, the actual melody. It's so grandiose. It's amazing. It's actually really good music.
That's Elise Nalbandian. She doesn't remember when We Are the World came out. She was just a baby in 1985. But she knows it well because she's from Ethiopia, and she works for the poverty alleviation group Oxfam. In fact, she runs Oxfam's hunger programs for much of East Africa. She's based in Nairobi, Kenya.
As to the song We Are the World or any initiative like it, I have to say initiatives like this song can be very, very important to bring awareness and funding.
Today, says Nalbandian, East and Central Africa once again need help. In fact, she says, compared to Ethiopia's drought in the 1980s, things now are much worse.
For example, in 2023, I can tell you across East and Central Africa, around 90 million people are experiencing acute levels of hunger.
90 million people. The root causes of the crisis have changed little since the mid-80s. Armed conflicts, political instability.
Poverty, inequality, the lack of justice. That includes the lack of gender justice, the lack of climate justice. All of these need to be addressed for us to have a world where a humanitarian crisis of this magnitude will not actually happen.
Nalbandian says celebrity songs are hardly a long-term solution for eradicating poverty, even if people keep trying, like Bob Geldof with his somewhat culturally tone-deaf Do They Know It's Christmas? There have also been big concerts like Live Aid. But USA for Africa, the organization behind We Are the World, says it's made $120 million since the video's first airing on MTV. Marcia Thomas is USA for Africa's director.
Over 90% of the money that's been earned has gone for projects and support for efforts on the continent.
The African continent, that is. The other 10%, it's gone to poverty alleviation programs in the U.S., With We Are the World's success, you might think, why not do a sequel? For one, says Oxfam's Elise Nalbandian, the model's a bit outdated, heavy on the savior syndrome.
And cringy?
Cringy, she says. As for Thomas?
No, it's not going to happen. Because we'd be competing with ourselves.
And she says they'd lose. Creating a song today to match We Are the World's staying power, she says, impossible. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
More than 150 years after they died, the remains of a young boy and an older man from the Pacific nation of Tonga are back home. They had been held at the Australian Museum in Sydney.
Those remains were repatriated to Tonga and laid to rest last week during a funeral service on the island of Ewa.
From the 1860s to well into the 20th century, the remains of Indigenous Australians and Pacific Islanders were stolen, exhibited, and swapped between institutions in Australia and abroad. Laura McBride is in charge of repatriations at the Australian Museum in Sydney. She says the remains were donated to the museum in a different era.
So the first ancestor was donated in 1875, and we believe that they were collected from the island of Tonga by Australian Naval Command.
That was a skull apparently obtained by a surgeon on a ship. McBride says no one knows how the surgeon came into possession of the remains, but it likely wouldn't have been difficult.
During this time, there was an active trade of Indigenous people by Westerners. So if they could find human remains that they knew that they could sell or keep for their own curiosities, they did.
The second set of remains, a skull and a skeleton, were found in a cave on the island of Ata, which is part of Tonga. They eventually ended up in a Pacific art collection in Sydney, and in 1969, the skull was donated to the Australian Museum.
Because there are no records of who this young boy and the older man were, the current king of Tonga, Tupou VI, bestowed names on them posthumously. Hundreds of people attended the funeral, including Tongan royalty. Pallbearers in traditional dress carried the remains in a decorated casket and lowered it into the ground.
Mana Funua, a descendant of the Ata Islanders, told Australia's ABC News that the funeral brought closure to the community.
Why it's important to me is that this is our national treasure. This is our inheritance.
It's also an opportunity to share the tragic history of Ata Island with the wider world. In 1863, an Australian whaler from Tasmania kidnapped 144 people from there, about half of the island's population, and sold them to slave traders who brought them to a slave market in Peru. When Tonga's king at the time heard what had happened, he had the survivors from Ata taken off the island and moved to the safer island of Ewa. Ata is uninhabited to this day.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.